Welcome back to the CritMedic Podcast, where we bring together the worlds of critical care and pre-hospital care. I'm your host, Dominic Walenzak, and today we're going to cover a hidden and underappreciated danger to our patients. Let's start off with a little scenario. It's 3 a.m., night shift. Don't normally work nights, but you picked up an extra shift to help out with vacancies in the schedule. You take a call for someone with chest pain, and you've given your aspirin and you've given your nitro. Now it's time for an IV, so you opt to start a saline trap. Your agency doesn't have pre-filled saline flushes, so you grab a vial from where your service ordinarily keeps the saline. As you are bouncing down the road in the dead of night, the label on the vial looks like sodium chloride 0.9%, like you expect. So you flush the saline trap. But suddenly, your patient shakes and stops breathing. You look down at the vial in your hands, and it becomes immediately clear what happened. The vial doesn't read sodium chloride 0.9%. It reads succinylcholine. How did this happen, we may ask ourselves. I thought I was a good provider. I was sure I checked the label. In the root cause analysis that good agencies should follow, there would be many factors identified that could lead to this kind of error. Confusingly similar drug names, packages, placed in the wrong locations, and so on. And those are very important causes, don't get me wrong. But there is one in particular that many EMS agencies do little to address, and many refuse to even acknowledge. The elephant in the room that I'm talking about is provider fatigue. Fatigue will affect every level of provider, from green basic EMT to the fancy flight and critical care paramedic. No matter how much we pretend that we're not affected, we are. And sometimes, it's imperceptible to us, like the subtle incapacitation that occurs in flight during slow depressurization. Speaking of depressurization, the airline industry has done a lot of study and research on this topic. Regulatory bodies have set strict limits on pilot flight hours. For instance, the FAA limits pilot flight time to 8 or 9 hours, depending on the start of the flight, with a mandatory rest period of 10 hours. Each pilot must also have a mandatory 30 consecutive hours off-duty each week. How many EMS services or providers have that? Despite such robust safeguards and regulations, fatigue still does occur. Internationally, in a survey of 6,000 pilots by the ECA, about 50% of pilots reported briefly falling asleep involuntarily while flying in episodes known as microsleep. In the UK, 1/3 of the pilots reported having woken up to find their colleague had also fallen asleep on the flight deck. That's scary. That's allegedly what happened on a Northwest flight that overshot an airport by 150 miles in 2009. In the survey, 3 out of 5 pilots reported making mistakes due to fatigue, with 4 out of 5 pilots in Germany reporting the same thing. In fact, 92% of German pilots reported feeling so tired that they were unfit for duty while on the flight deck. All this with strict regulations in place on hours worked and fatigue. Do we really think that we are exempt from this in EMS? Do we really think that working 80-plus hour weeks and 18 or 24-hour shifts is going to produce better results? The next question we need to ask is, what is fatigue? NASA scientist Dr. Samuel Strauss, in his book Pilot Fatigue, defines it as a state not related to an illness, resulting in a decreased ability to maintain function or workload due to mental or physical stress. It has also been described as a progressive decline in alertness and in the ability to process information. There are 2 major factors inducing fatigue: sleep loss and circadian rhythm disruption. Generally, you'll find that definitions are pretty much consistent among different sources. But what does this actually mean? Fatigue occurs as a natural consequence of being awake, whether we are working or not. As we perform tasks that cause stress or require concentration, our alertness gradually decreases. This results in the subtle creep of errors in judgment and calculation. In extreme states, you may even encounter errors of cognition or registration. So that vial that we grabbed, when we were expecting to see sodium chloride, we saw the label, but our fatigued mind failed to register the full context of what it said. Subconsciously, our mind was expecting sodium chloride, and this is what it filled in the blank. This is an example of confirmation bias, an error of information processing. Checking your rights of administration can't stop this kind of error. And these errors can manifest themselves in many forms as well. We may develop erroneous interpretation and correlation of data. We may see signs of one condition and jump on it, rendering incorrect treatment for that patient's condition. Whereas if we were looking at it with a fresh set of eyes, we would be able to see all the evidence and draw the correct conclusion. Our memories also tend to develop an erroneous bias, and our perception of time is even more distorted than normal. Our ability to do calculations is also impaired. Wake up your partner at 3 o'clock in the morning and ask them how many drops of standard concentration dopamine they'd need to give an 80-kilogram patient using a 60-drop set to achieve 5 mics per kg per minute. See what kind of answer you get. Go ahead, it'll be fun. So, we have an understanding of the problem and how it can affect us, but is there any actual science to this? Well, yes. Yes, there is. Studies have found that for duty periods of 10 to 12 hours, the relative risk of an accident was 1.7 times higher than for shorter shifts. And for duties of 13 hours or more, the relative risk was over 5.5 times higher. It has been established that both fatigue and risk build up over the course of a duty shift, such that they are substantially higher towards the end of longer duties. In addition, studies have shown that some crews were having difficulty remaining awake during overnight shifts of 11 hours or more. These studies show that night shifts are far more prone to severe fatigue than day shifts. Finally, it has been established that if insufficient sleep has been obtained between consecutive duties, then fatigue and risk will increase cumulatively. Fatigue is cumulative and depends on periods of rest to reset the clock, if you will. But fatigue is just part of the syndrome of being overworked. Our family life suffers, and EMS is among the professions with some of the highest divorce rates. Overwork can result in depression, can worsen PTSD, and can ultimately result in suicide. The Code Green campaign has been a tremendously beneficial influence in bringing awareness to the mental health of America's first responders. Overwork can result in higher rates of burnout and turnover. Overwork can result in compassion fatigue and, from a business standpoint, result in a lower rate of customer or patient satisfaction. So we need to be aware that we are not supermen. We are just ordinary people doing a job, a vitally important job, and we need to adopt some standards as a matter of professional pride and safety. At the very least, individuals should be aware of some of the effects of fatigue and how to spot them. If we're aware, then we can take some steps to try and mitigate them. If a provider says they're fatigued, we need to provide them with rest. It should be noted that Dr. Strauss specified that the only effective treatment for fatigue is adequate sleep. Everything else is just a band-aid, but still worth talking about. Diet and hydration is one way of mitigating fatigue to some extent. Adequate hydration, especially water, is important. Eating high-protein meals has also been shown to have some benefit. While diet and hydration might be helpful in promoting sleep or staying awake in the short term, research revealed nothing to suggest that being appropriately fed and hydrated could overcome the severe adverse effects of sleep loss and circadian rhythm disruption. On a side note, those two-day, two-night schedules that have become popular with some services are horrible for circadian rhythm disruptions. The Air Force's 1997 Leader's Guide to Crew Endurance suggests avoiding frequent rotations, maintaining the same day or night shifts for a period of 2 to 3 weeks. Before I go off too far on a tangent, let's talk about the last option, pharmacologic options. Caffeine is probably the most widely used pharmacologic option that is often taken in the form of a brown-colored elixir. But there are other medications that promote alertness and wakefulness. Amphetamines have been used by the Air Force during deployment periods, like Operation Enduring Freedom, with some measure of success. Some forms of amphetamines are used in the civilian world to combat shift work disorders, like methylphenidate or dextroamphetamine. Another one that's been increasingly popular lately is Provigil. On the flip side of things, some providers need help getting to sleep due to circadian disruptions. There are a whole host of pharmacologic options available, like Ambien, Sonata, or Restoril, but it's important to note that all these pharmacologic options can build a dependence, and it is not a substitute for rest and sleep. So, consider these as a last resort and a temporary measure only. Lastly, there is something that needs addressing, CritMedic listeners. This is something where I need your help. While it is up to every provider to make sure that they don't schedule themselves for more than they can handle, there is something that bypasses this, something that is fundamentally inappropriate and even potentially dangerous. I'm talking about mandatory, involuntary overtime. And I don't mean, oh, I had to take a late call and I really didn't want to, or my relief is going to be late so I have to hold over for them. No, that's an unavoidable part of the job. What I'm referring to is the, we are short-staffed, so you will come in on Friday, regardless of what else you had planned in your life that day, or you will be punished. This indentured servitude is not part of the job. It represents a fundamental disrespect of employees and their lives outside of the job. It put patients, your partners, and the public at risk. Providers should not be made to work more than they feel that they are capable of. To do otherwise is an affront to logic. It puts dollars ahead of patients and providers. And nurses in New York agree with that. That's why, in 2009, they had passed a law prohibiting the practice of mandatory overtime for nurses, except in circumstances of disaster. And that's exactly the same kind of protections we need enacted for our profession. Fortunately, one paramedic in New York has started laying the foundation for just such a law. Joel Olskamp is an intelligent provider with a history of battling with legislation and regulation in the state. He's also a former coworker of mine until he was run over by a runaway supervisor vehicle, ending his career. I wish that I could say that was a joke, but sadly that's not the case. Anyways, Joe has put together a petition of support to get such a law enacted and is working with a New York State senator to do just that. But we need to show support for this, especially from folks in New York. And that's where you come in, Crit Medic listeners. I would like to ask you, I need you to go to the petition and sign your support. It will be featured prominently on social media for this podcast as well as in the show notes. Please, go support it. It'll take a minute of your time. Speaking of time, that's all the time we have for this week. I hope that this has brought the issue of provider fatigue to your attention so that you can catch it before it becomes a problem. Remember, mistakes from fatigue can happen to all calibers of providers. Until next time, Crit Medic listeners, stay well rested and keep thinking differently.